You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a guest shares some unique twists on a classic Wisconsin cocktail, the Brandy Old Fashioned. First, the science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM fields, have struggled with diversity for quite a while now. In 2011, whites and Asians made up 69% of the national workforce, but they make up more than 80% of the STEM workforce. Our next guest studied the diversity problem in STEM fields. She says part of the reason these industries struggle to attract more Black and Latino people in particular is because of how STEM careers are marketed to them as students. Ebony McGee is an associate professor of diversity and STEM education at Vanderbilt University. Ebony, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about trying to get more students, including students of color, into STEM fields. Is the normal pitch to those students, hey, you're going to make lots of money?
Yes. So the normal pitch is you're going to make lots of money, or you're going to protect us from China, or you're going to help us maintain our superpower status. And that message isn't really resonating with students of color who don't want to build bombs. They want to build communities and really impact the lives of others.
Right. We're really treading water, aren't we, when it comes to people of color going into the science and technology fields? We're not moving the needle at all lately.
Well, actually, in terms of interest, there's high levels of interest of students of color wanting to matriculate through STEM. Oftentimes, once they get into STEM, they don't see a real connection between wanting to make a difference in their communities and the STEM technologies, or the way that STEM curriculum is currently marketed, which is kind of away from social justice or away from community building and really all about technology for technological purposes and not for purposes of social justice.
And that's where your research comes in. You interviewed 38 different students and asked them about their life stories. What motivates them to go into these fields, the science, technology, engineering, and math?
So we did find some traditional means of going into STEM, like to make money, but it was often even couched to make money so I can support my family who is struggling financially. So even in the auspice of those really traditional motivations, we found a sense of empathy towards family uplift. But we also saw folks really wanting to do STEM to do things like market the injustices of police cameras in their communities and use the technology that they've learned in order to talk about the ways in which their communities were surveillance, or to build technologies for autistic youth, or to do something that was much more community-centered, much more holistic in nature than we often think about what STEMers actually want to go into in terms of their career trajectories.
Can you tell us a little bit about the backgrounds of the students you talked to?
So the background was these were students who were at predominantly white institutions, also HBCUs. We even had a couple of Latinx students from Hispanic-serving institutions. So it was across the board in terms of whether they had AP advanced courses or not. We all found an overwhelming thread of them wanting to embark in equity-oriented STEM pursuits.
And did experiencing any kind of racism or inequality in their lives inform how some of these high-achieving STEM students see their career paths?
Yes, many of the students, particularly who wanted to kind of give back in a mentorship way, whether that either being becoming a professor or starting a mentoring program or some tutorial programming, really wanted to do that. So students of color who were coming up through the STEM pipeline didn't experience the same racism or racism and sexism that they experience while matriculating through their programming. So, yes, a direct correlation.
We're talking to Ebony McGee from Vanderbilt University, looking at what motivates students of color to go into the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and math, and how those programs could better pitch themselves to those students. So, Ebony, what I'm hearing and reading in your research is it isn't just the gosh wow of the science and technology itself. It's how can I use this, if I'm understanding the students you talked to correctly, to benefit my community or a community? How can I use these tools to solve problems for people? Is that right?
That's correct. But I do want to say that they are very passionate about the STEM itself, but they see it being intersectional with being able to do good in the world. So either in their communities or in the larger global community, or to have some purpose. Many students said that they don't want to have a legacy saying, I built some superpowered technological product that didn't help society. They would rather have a legacy that was more universal in terms of being providing an equitable stance in the environment.
So for, say, an academic institution that wants to promote STEM for students of color, what could they look at your research and take and put into action to help bring in the students and keep them and motivate them?
Well, I think that there's faculty across the country who are doing really innovative things with STEM technologies and incorporating a more equity ethic-based methodology to the ways in which they do STEM. So I think gaining more faculty like that would really kind of increase interest and retention of students who want to do STEM in a sort of non-traditional social justice type of way. I also think a focus on recruiting Black and Latinx faculty in particular. We find that those faculty are often doing the kind of work that the students want to do just byproduct of their own background. So having those faculty there, you kind of kill two birds with one stone.
And you use that phrase, the equity ethic. What does that mean?
So an equity ethic, we talk about really just having a concern for helping others, and that concern emanates within their career trajectories, their personal trajectories, and really feeling as though they have kind of a disconnect with the way STEM is currently being marketed and their want and ability to contribute to their society.
I think a lot of people fall in love with these fields, at least some people that I've talked to, at a very early age. How can we take these ideas and make sure, you know, in K through 12 education, that this way of thinking about science and technology education is happening as early as possible?
Yeah, I think we can incorporate some of the things that I'm talking about on the college curriculum. They can certainly be incorporated into K-12. And we do a good job of that when we think about biomedical careers. So students learn from a very early age to become a doctor means that I have to have empathy, I have to care about people, you know, I have to be somewhat altruistic. We can do these things when we're talking about building power products or environmental engineering. So we can make those marketing campaigns happen similarly to how we're doing in the biomedical field if we just take the time to understand that these are the factors that really matter to many students, not just students of color.
That's interesting. It's kind of a marketing issue, because if I wanted to capture a stock photo of a scientist, I guess I'd have somebody looking at a test tube or through a microscope or something like that. It sounds like marketing, creating more images and even role models of people putting their science and technology into action.
Right, exactly. Like, there's organizations like Borders, I'm probably not saying it right, Engineering Without Borders, you know, and they're doing a lot of advocacy work. So we have people in STEM who are currently doing this work, but what we see on TV is the Microsoft or the Googles, and, you know, we don't really see a direct connection to being altruistic or having empathy. And I think that those other types of STEMers who are actually doing the work needs to be more marketed and promoted.
What do we lose as a society if we're missing out on all these potential scientists and technologists and engineers and mathematicians if we are ignoring, if we aren't bringing the people of color into the fields?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent question. So the 38 students that we interviewed, all of them are considered high achieving, but over half of them are considering going outside of STEM because they can't reconcile the conflict between wanting to serve their society and wanting to do STEM in the way that it's been traditionally marketed to them. So I think we could be losing out on, let's say, flying around in cars, because in order to do that, you need the diversity of thought, the diversity of background, the diversity of talent in order to create diversity in technology and innovation. So I think we could be losing out on decades of innovation by not including up to 50% of the population who doesn't happen to be white and some Asian groups.
And I want to talk, before we wrap up, about role models. I've heard a story from Neil deGrasse Tyson saying early in his career, people tried to talk him into going into law or civil rights because he was a genius, he could have made a difference, and he ultimately decided he could be a really positive influence by being this African-American man now on TV screens and magazines all over the country talking about science. How important are our role models?
Role models and mentors are crucial. I mean, even the students of color in this study talk about even just walking down the hallway and seeing a person of color, even if they don't actually speak, is like a breath of relief. In those spaces where it's mostly white and mostly Asian, and they don't get opportunities to see themselves, you know, particularly in the faculty members. So having role models and mentors or even people in the building, you know, seems to be such a big source of healing for these students who are often experiencing a lot of racialized trauma as a result of the way STEM departments are the way the environment of STEM departments are.
We'll leave it there for now. Ebony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ebony McGee is an associate professor of diversity and STEM education at Vanderbilt University. She joined us to talk about what motivates students of color pursuing STEM careers. Now, if you're traveling around the country and you want a bartender to know you're from Wisconsin, just order a brandy old-fashioned sweet. The drink is a classic here in the state and strange and puzzling for most of the rest of the world. There's a classic recipe, sure, but mixologists around Wisconsin have been putting their own twists on the old-fashioned for decades. Our next guest traveled around the state to find some of those unique variations, and you can join in with your favorite. Where's the best place to get an old-fashioned, and what's your favorite spin on the drink? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Laura Schulte is a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Among other things, she's the cocktail reporter. Nice work if you can get it. She joins us from our studio in Wausau. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, what's the basic old-fashioned? What goes into it?
So the basic old-fashioned, going back, you know, to the early 1900s, late 1800s, we're talking, you know, you've got your base of either brandy or you've got your base of whiskey or bourbon, a little bit of sweetness maybe, but usually it was just those bitters and the alcohol that went in there.
And then there's the brandy old-fashioned sweet.
Yeah, so the brandy old-fashioned sweet or sour, depending on your preferences, came about during and after Prohibition in Wisconsin. So the research I did shows that people in Wisconsin did not want to stop drinking alcohol when the country forbid it. So they were getting their alcohol, they were distilling it themselves, or they were bringing it across the Canadian border. But it turns out that alcohol that they had during Prohibition was like pretty gross, so they wanted to mask those flavors. So they made it sweeter. They added fruit and they added all of that sugar to mask the flavor of the alcohol. And that just stuck around after Prohibition ended, and Wisconsin never lost that sweet tooth for their drinks.
And it's the brandy old-fashioned here. Are we clear on why it's brandy here and basically nowhere else?
Yeah, the love for brandy actually is rooted in Wisconsin's heritage. So Wisconsin was made up of a lot of European immigrants. And the World's Fair, the Korbel brothers, brought in their new brandy that they had just started making. And all of these Wisconsinites were in Chicago for the World's Fair. And they were like, hey, this brandy is pretty great. This is what our ancestors drank. This is what we like. So they took the Korbel back to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee, wherever they were from. And people loved it. And it caught on. And now Wisconsin is like one of the major drinkers of Korbel brandy. Like, there are like certain rumors that like Wisconsin has its own like shipping dock for Korbel brandy and stuff like that. But we certainly do have a taste for the alcohol.
So we've got the brandy, and so and we've got this fruitier, sweeter old fashioned, thanks to the nasty prohibition era booze that no one wanted to taste. So the standard, what goes in it? We've got the muddled cherries. What is the key to the your basic brandy old fashioned sweet now?
So your basic brandy old-fashioned sweet, you're going to start out with a cherry and simple syrup or a sugar cube, depending on what bar you go to, and then an orange, and you keep the flesh of the orange on the rind. But when you muddle it, you only make sure to crush that flesh of the orange so you don't get any of that bitterness out of the peel. And then you throw in your brandy and your bitters. It's usually the, you know, your Angostura bitters are the typical ones, but... Yeah, and then it's mixed together, and depending on ice, some places will do blocks of ice because they melt slower and dilute slower, and some places will use chipped ice because it kind of helps take that bitter edge off of the alcohol when you drink it.
And then I've known bartenders who traveled around trying different places, old fashions, and seeing if they could replicate them. There's the basic recipe, and then everybody seems to want to put their own spin on it, right?
Oh, yeah.
We're talking to Laura Schulte, reporter and cocktail reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. She's in our Wausau studio today talking about the brandy old fashioned here in Wisconsin. She checked out a few unique permutations around the state. If you'd like, you can join in if you have a favorite old fashioned, a favorite place and time to drink it, and a favorite version of it that you make or purchase. Call in at 800-642-1234. Now, Laura, you checked out, you featured a few different ones really across the state. Let's start in Green Bay, a bar called the Libertine, and you say they hand cut their ice there.
Yeah, so every day before the bar opens, they go in and they hand cut their ice, and it's a very painstaking process. They have, you know, hand saws, and then they have to cut it down to the exact right dimension. There's a science actually behind it about how fast the ice will melt when it's in a certain shape and a certain size. So that's this beginning. Usually people don't get to see the cutting process. We got a little sneak peek because it's usually done before the bars open every day. But yeah,
well, it's not even a secret. It's just they do it before you're there.
Yeah. But even the ice is down to a perfect science. The ice has to be perfectly see-through with, you know, without any kind of dilution in there before they'll even put it in the drink. It's very fine-tuned down to a science, but it goes in a wonderful old-fashioned.
And then La Cave in La Crosse, hickory-smoked old-fashions?
Yeah, that was definitely one of the coolest experiences. So they start with hickory wood chips that have either been soaked in bourbon or gin, depending on the time of the year. They light those on fire, and then they extinguish it with the glass, and they leave the glass sitting over the smoke for a while so it condensates and kind of runs down the sides. And while they make their old-fashioned, and they make their own bitters there. They don't use any fruit in the old-fashioned. It's all flavors from the bitters. So you'll get your typical bitters flavor, and then they have some orange bitters, some coffee bitters, so you get a lot of different tastes on the palate with that. And then the whole old-fashioned goes into the glass, and you get that really, really smoky aroma in there.
Wow.
And it hits your tongue and your nose at about the same time. It's kind of like drinking a campfire, but it's really pleasant.
Let's bring on a caller now. Daniel is on the line in Door County. Daniel, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you got for us, Daniel?
I'm actually a bartender in Sister Bay, Wisconsin, at a place called JJ's, and we muddle our old-fashioned the old-fashioned way. But a couple of years ago, I devised a new drink in which, instead of using sugar, I used artificial sweetener.
Is there a demand for this?
Well, it was quite funny because I named it the Ryan Braun. At the time, the disgraced outfielder was serving a steroid suspension.
Right, so right, yeah.
It was very popular, but the drink is incredibly popular. It's amazed at how folks love it.
Artificial sweetener. So you don't? I don't like artificial sweetener usually. That doesn't put people off.
Oh, the thing was, it was more of a joke than anything. But
people,
you know,
like it.
Folks were drinking it, so there's been a bunch of different variations that we've used, but. We just pretty much make the classic one.
Gotcha. Daniel, thanks for calling. I want to get another bartender. It looks like Mark is with us in Eau Claire. Mark, hi.
Hi, I'm not the bartender.
Oh, you're not.
I met an interesting bartender at a bar in the Twin Cities, a hotel bar. When he found out I was from Wisconsin, he asked if I wanted an old-fashioned. and he said, I said, I'm in sales. He said, watch this. And so he poured the bitters in a martini glass, you know, the wide martini glass, and then he lit it and swirled it around. And so in about 30 seconds, he had 10 more people trying to figure out what he was making and ordering old-fashioned for that sale.
Fantastic, Mark. Thank you so much. And, Laura, I want to get to one more. You went to a Drink Wisconsinably in Milwaukee, I think it was, and they tried to really do a perfect straight-up old-fashioned.
Oh, yeah. They have a great old-fashioned there. You can either get one out of the bubbler, which I, for those of you who don't know what a bubbler was, I didn't when I moved to Wisconsin. It's a water fountain in other parts of the country. But yeah, the old-fashioned mix comes straight out of the bubbler. It's made by Soul Boxer, which is a Wisconsin company. And they put your choice of sweet or sour soda in there, which is also made in Wisconsin, and put some ice in there, and you get it that way. Or they can hand muddle an old fashioned for you, which is, turns out, it's a little bit sweeter when they do it that way, but still delicious. And they garnish it with a cherry and a cheese curd.
And Laura, before we wrap up, just briefly, are you old fashioned out after this research? Or are you still looking for more?
You know what? I wasn't a huge old fashioned drinker to begin with. And now I can say that confidently that every bar I go to, I order an old fashioned.
We'll leave it there, Laura. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Laura Schulte, cocktail reporter and a reporter in general for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. A recent memo sent to local priests by the Madison Diocese caused some outrage among Catholics in Wisconsin, some of them, and around the country. The memo outlines how to handle requests for funeral rites for gay and lesbian parishioners in open same-sex relationships. The memo seeks to avoid what it calls a scandal. It also says that priests should consider, among other issues, whether or not the deceased advocated for what the memo refers to as the gay lifestyle, or whether or not the person repented before their death. Questions have arisen since the document was leaked about how the Catholic Church should approach working with its LGBTQ parishioners and whether or not the memo reflects the values of Catholics today. Father James Martin joins us now. He's a Jesuit priest and editor-at-large for America Magazine. He's the author of the book Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. Father Martin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Before we get to the wider issues you tackle in your book, what's your reaction to what you've seen of this memo here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's lamentable because it focuses just on one group of people, and particularly on the sexual morality of one group of people. I think the problem with a lot of letters like these is not that the church doesn't have the authority to say, you know, who, you know, is admitted to the sacraments, but rather that there aren't sort of comparable restrictions on, you know, straight people who are, you know, not living according to the sexual morality of the church. So, for example, you know, we would never say, imagine a case where you have a young man, you know, who, God forbid, is in college and dies in an accident. You know, you would never say you can't bury him because he was having sex with his girlfriend, and you would never bar the girlfriend from coming to the funeral. And that's the problem, I think, with a lot of these things. They really are just focused on LGBT people.
The concern seems to be not wanting to be seen as endorsing something that's contrary to the teachings of the church. So the memo talked about not recognizing, say, that same-sex partner or spouse. So as an analogy, that the girlfriend you mentioned might be allowed to be at the funeral, but the funeral ceremony wouldn't maybe give her a prominent role. Is that a valid comparison?
Yeah, that is a valid comparison, and I think the point is that when we have had funerals like that, the girlfriend usually is, you know, front and center, and people interview her, and she might give a eulogy, and there's never a hint that because the couple was having premarital sex, which is also against church teaching, that she should not only be not allowed to come and not allowed to speak, but also that the guy, you know, let's say the young man, the young college student, wouldn't get a Catholic funeral. So I think it's really what the Catechism calls a situation of unjust discrimination. That is, you're focusing just on this group of people, the LGBT community, and just on their sexual morality. And, you know, it's unthinkable that that would happen to a young straight couple who are, you know, living together or sleeping together before being married. It's just unthinkable. And so I think it's really lamentable that we're focusing so much on just LGBT people.
And I want to get into the wider issues you tackle in your book now. And I understand you started really considering the relationship between your church and the LGBT community after the Orlando nightclub shooting at a gay dance club. Can you talk about that?
Right. I had written a few articles in America Magazine, where I work as an editor, about LGBT Catholics, but I really hadn't taken a kind of sort of front and center role, as it were. And I noticed that after the Pulse nightclub massacre, that very few bishops reached out or expressed condolences or even sympathy to the LGBT community. And those that did, could barely bring themselves to mention the words gay or LGBT. And it really shocked me, because if that were in, let's say, a Methodist church, God forbid, or a Presbyterian church, and people were massacred, you know that bishops would say, we stand with our Methodist brothers and sisters, or we stand with our Presbyterian brothers and sisters, but there was nothing comparable to the LGBT community. And it really reminded me that, you know, even in death, LGBT people are largely invisible in the Catholic Church. And that sort of led to the publication of this book.
What response would you like to have seen from the church, from bishops around the country?
Well, the same kind of response that the U.S. Bishops Conference or any bishops have when a similar tragedy happens. I mean, if there's it was a shooting, right? And I think after Las Vegas, for example, which I think, unfortunately exceeded the number of people that were killed in Orlando, we had church leaders and bishops, and the U.S. Bishops Conference expressed their support and their sympathy. And I think there was a sense of their being tongue-tied, because what happened in Orlando happened to largely a gay population. I think it illustrates this great gap that there is in our church between church leadership and LGBT people.
Talking to Father James Martin, author of the book Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. And Father Martin, what is formal church policy when it comes to LGBT issues? I don't know if that's a quick and easy answer to give, but broad strokes, what is policy?
Well, the broad strokes, first of all, is that they're beloved children of God. That's the most important thing. So it is not a sin to be LGBT, right? And they are to be respected. They're baptized Catholics, if we're talking about, just Catholics. Homosexual activity and same-sex marriage is off the table. That's impermissible. But, when we talk about church teaching, I think we also need to look beyond the catechism and look at the Gospels. And church teaching is fundamentally the Gospels. And Jesus asks us to reach out to people on the margins, to welcome them, and to really make people feel included. So I think that also needs to be factored into the situation.
That seems like a tough starting point for bridge building if the policy is this part of your behavior and the option of being married, they're off the table from the start. I mean, how do you bridge that gap?
Well, I would say yes and no, because, there are certainly a lot of LGBT people. I would say most LGBT Catholics disagree with that. But, their lives are more than just sex, and their lives are more than just marriage. Most LGBT people who I know simply want to be first accepted, as parishioners, as faithful parishioners, so feeling welcome in their own parishes, not always being, castigated from the pulpit, not always being singled out, having special outreach programs to them, maybe LGBT outreach groups. So, there's a lot of stuff that we can talk about that does not need to sort of go into the areas of sexual relations or marriage. It's like saying, if you were to get up in front of a group of college students and talk about, giving them advice or talk about their future, you wouldn't only talk about sex. So I think what's happened in the church is we've reduced LGBT people simply to sexual beings. And I think that's part of who they are, but it's not the totality of who they are.
There's been some response in Catholic communities from other priests, among others, to your book and what you've been saying. I understand you've been uninvited from some speaking gigs in part because of this. Do you see the church hierarchy being ready to listen to what you're saying?
Yeah, it's important to note that the book has the approval of my Jesuit superiors, two cardinals, including Cardinal Kevin Farrell, who works in the Vatican, endorsed it. Also Cardinal Joseph Tobin, Archbishop of Newark, three archbishops, three bishops. You know, and 99% of the people of God, that is the Catholic faithful, have been really positive and have welcomed the book. And, you know, that's really clear, especially LGBT Catholics. Yeah, and there's a very vocal sort of far-right fringe group, I would say, who are really opposed to the book and are really opposed to the whole idea of any sort of welcome to LGBT Catholics. Now, that may be a kind of a bad summary of the response. There are some thoughtful critics, but, you know, there are a lot of Catholics out there who, you know, are very welcoming to the book. So that's the group I tend to focus on.
And you also pitch this message not just to the church hierarchy, but to LGBT Catholics, too. What would you like to see from them?
Well, the book's subtitle is taken from the Catechism, Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. That's what the church is supposed to be doing as an outreach. That's right from the Catechism. But I say that while the onus is on the institutional church to reach out to these people who have felt so marginalized, that is LGBT Catholics, for so long, the LGBT Catholic community needs to respond, you know, with respect, compassion, and sensitivity towards church leaders because they're Christian, basically. It's a hard thing to hear. I think it's very challenging, but, you know, that's part of being a Christian, which is treating the other person with dignity and respect. So I'm calling for a bridge where both sides are, you know, willing to listen and willing to encounter one another, which is one of Pope Francis's sort of favorite words, encounter. And I think listening is the beginning part of all of this.
We're talking to Father James Martin right now. He's a Jesuit priest and editor at large for America Magazine. He's with us now to talk about the relationship between the Catholic Church and its lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender parishioners after a memo from the Catholic Diocese in Madison about how to handle funeral rites for Catholics who have openly had same-sex partnerships. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to that memo? If you're a Catholic member of the LGBTQ community or vice versa, what was your reaction to the news? And what do you think about your relationship to the church, what the church thinks of you? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about the relationship between the Catholic Church and the LGBT community. That's been in the news in Wisconsin with a controversy over a Madison Diocese memo on funeral rites for members of that community. Our guest is Father James Martin. He's a Jesuit priest and editor-at-large for America Magazine. He's been writing about this, the wider issues involved here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about that memo? How do you think the Catholic Church should work with the LGBT community? And vice versa. Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Aaron is on the line in Antioch. Aaron, hi.
Hey. Good afternoon, Rob. Hi, Father. This is Aaron. I just had one comment, and that is, this is the first I'm hearing of the memo, so I don't know the details of it, but the example that was given about a man in college who has a girlfriend, the example cited assumes that that gentleman is having sex with his girlfriend, and I think it's incorrect to assume that. One might have a stronger possibility to assume that somebody who has same-sex attraction and is living that lifestyle probably is engaging in sexual activity with their partner. But I don't think that we should assume that either person is having sexual relations with their partner. So I just thought that example was poor and is incorrect and not fair to assume that a man in college is having sex with his girlfriend.
Aaron, thanks for the call. And Father Martin, maybe that gets back to your original point that that in this case the funeral rite shouldn't bring up the sex element in either case.
Well, then we can use the example of a couple who is engaged and living together. Right. I mean, you know, there's a couple who we can probably assume is, you know, at least intimate with one another. And if one or the other partner is killed, to not have the engaged person come would be unthinkable. And, you know, I mean, you can make the same case that, you know, if there was a same-sex couple living together, that they're not having sex either. The caller is assuming, therefore, that all the same-sex couples are just having sex, too. So I think the problem is we are so focused on treating LGBT people and looking at them through the lens of sex, 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 and chastity that we are reducing them simply to sexual beings and, you know, sort of elevating same-sex relations as the worst and the only sin. I mean, you could also look at questions of funerals for the following categories: people who are divorced and remarried without an annulment, you know, people who are divorced, which is against the Gospels, right? Jesus is against that. Men who have fathered children out of wedlock, women who have had children out of wedlock. I mean, there are multiple sort of categories of people in, you know, who are straight, you know, and their sexual, you know, wrongdoings, you know, as according to the Catholic Church, who we regularly give funerals to. And, you know, we give funerals to people on, you know, who are like mafia people, people who have been in jail. I mean, so this kind of relentless focus on same-sex relations, I think, is really odd to sort of, you know, to just completely focus on them to the exclusion of the sexual morality of straight people, I think is really unfair and unjust.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Go next to Charlie with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you. Father, I agree with you that people are more than just sexual beings, but again, sexual activity is a very large part of a lot of people's lives. From marriage, heterosexual marriage, it is the reason why people get married. It's to produce children. The Catholic Church has said that homosexual sexual activity is inauthentic, and yet we see in nature multiple, in fact, numerous types of homosexual behavior in the animal kingdom. Can't we now assume that homosexual activity for some people is actually authentic and not inauthentic, and we should recognize that and not allow that to obscure people from being part of the church?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Father Martin, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a very important question. I think, you know, as we reflect on, you know, science and psychology and physiology, biology, it's important for the church to continue to reflect on you know, homosexuality and all kinds of sexuality. I think one of the biggest strides, you know, to this gentleman's phone call is that I think you will find very few people now in the Catholic Church, and this was, you know, different 40 or 50 years ago, that would say that it's not innate. You know, I mean, there are very few, I think, reputable theologians and certainly priests and pastors and bishops and church leaders, lay leaders as well, you know, who now don't understand that you are born that way, right? And you are born, you know, with that sexual orientation. So I think that's a real step forward. Now, I think that raises a host of questions in terms of the Catholic sort of approach to that. You know, what does that mean, therefore? Is it as culpable? What does that mean in terms of natural law? So I think it's a very important question. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that you know, we're moving in this is that more and more people are coming out, more and more people are known to their families and to their parishes and to their, you know, church communities, and we're able to reflect on that a little bit more now that we are able to listen to people. And that's one of the things I'm calling for in my book, just listening to people's experiences of who they are, how they got that way, and what their hopes and dreams are.
Thanks for your call, Charlie. We're talking to Father James Martin about the relationship between the Catholic Church and the lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual community. We'll go next to Michelle on the line in Green Bay. Michelle, hi.
Hi, thanks. So I appreciate the discussion about sexual behavior, and I actually thought it was a good analogy, the college student analogy, but you know, we haven't said anything about the T in LGBTQ, the transgender people. This is not about necessarily about sexual behavior, this one or that one. It's about the identity of the person. And is the church saying to transgender people, you are not who you don't know who you really are. We know who you are. If that's the case, that's a whole different issue. And I think, you know, I know people who are divorced Catholics who are told by the church, you're not really divorced because it was a sacramental marriage. And so you just think you're divorced unless you get an annulment. You know, that those, when the church says you are not who you think you are not who you know yourself to be, I think that's a whole different area. And I'd just like to hear Father Martin's, you know, take on that transgender part of the
Michelle, thanks. Gotcha. Father Martin, what do you say?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I had sort of different layers of answer. First of all, we have to sort of think about what we mean when we say the church, right? What does the church say? Well, it's beyond just, you know, the Pope and bishops and the hierarchy. The church is also pastors and lay workers who are working in parishes, mothers and fathers. So the church, I think, says different things to transgender people. For example, the Pope says something very different than, say, the lay principal of a Catholic high school, right? I mean, that's the church, too, where a lot of transgender children, for example, are feeling, welcome or not, basically. So we have to be careful about the church. It's not a monolith, in a sense. The other thing is that I think secular society is still coming to grips with and still trying to understand transgenderism, right? And so, in a sense, I am not surprised that the church is still reflecting on this. So I'm always very careful in, kind of offering my opinion on this because I know very little about it. I know transgender people, and I'm learning. I think what is incumbent for the church right now is to listen again. I mean, we are still just coming to understand that, right? And it's still sort of becoming more and more out in the open. So I think what the church needs to do is listen to these people and their experiences. I met a couple a few months ago in Boston, and it was a cisgender woman, a woman who had been born a woman, and a transgender woman, a woman who had been born a man, and they were married. And they said, we've been married for 25 years. And I was kind of shocked because, same-sex marriage had not been, legal for that long in Massachusetts. Well, it turned out that they were married when the transgender woman was a man. And I thought, well, this is really interesting. What can the church learn from them about fidelity and about love? And so the church, I think, is called to listen to these people because, their experiences are important. And the Holy Spirit, to use some theological language, is at work through them, too.
Thanks a lot for that call, Michelle. And Father Martin, you're making the case that a lot of people need to listen more. Do you feel like, as you try to spread that message, people are listening to you within the church, within the LGBT community?
I think for the most part, yes. And I just had lunch with a bishop today, believe it or not, in New York, and we had a long conversation. People, I think, are more open because people know more and more LGBT people. Even 40 or 50 years ago would have been this huge mystery and this kind of huge scandal. But, more and more people are out in parish life, certainly in family life, but in parish life, too. I mean, music ministers and directors of religious education and teachers and all sorts of people. So the church, I think, is, the church, the hierarchical church and the institutional church is more willing now to listen to people, which I think is all to the good.
Father Martin, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Father James Martin. He's a Jesuit priest and the editor-at-large for America magazine. He's the author of the book Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. We started, among other issues, with a memo leaked from the Madison Catholic Diocese on how to handle funeral rites for people who had participated in same-sex relationships.